We also had the chance to meet with some physicians who treat patients who have these risk factors, and they're interested in learning more about how to assess their patient's weight.
What's more important, weight circumference or BMI?
Well, they're really both important, but sometimes doctors only have time to do one, and if I was forced to choose, I would say BMI. But they both should be vital signs, both the body mass index and the waist circumference. The waist circumference is going to give you an idea of how high the risk is, but you need the BMI also to diagnose obesity. And, you know, with the BMI, it is weight in kilograms over height in meters squared, but you should have a chart in each examining room. Just plot the weight and the height, and you've got the BMI on these charts, and you can get them anywhere.
Well, as you well know, some physicians refer to central adiposity as well as the other risk factors that we've already been discussing as metabolic syndrome. What exactly is metabolic syndrome?
Well, metabolic syndrome has been defined in different places. It was first recognized by the World Health Organization, and it focused on insulin resistance and diabetes. If you had evidence of insulin resistance or had type 2 diabetes or pre-diabetes, then you had to have at least two additional criteria, one of which was abdominal obesity, and the way that that was indexed or measured was by waist-hip ratio greater than 0.9 in the man and greater than 0.85 in a woman. Dyslipidemia was another important component. So if you had a markedly low HDL cholesterol, less than 35 in a man, less than 40 in a woman, and an elevated triglycerides, or if you had hypertension, if you had two of those additional criteria, you were called the metabolic syndrome.
Then you also have the NSEP ATP3 guidelines. That criteria suggests that you need three of five criteria to make a diagnosis of metabolic syndrome. So you need abdominal obesity, which is defined as a waist circumference over 40 inches in men or over 35 inches in women. You also need serum triglycerides equal to or greater than 150. You need a serum HDL in men less than 40, in women less than 50. You need a systolic blood pressure over 130 or equal to 130, a diastolic blood pressure greater than or equal to 85, or being on treatment for hypertension. And then you also need a fasting blood sugar of greater than 100. And notice that this is a lower number than the former 110 for prediabetes. We now see prediabetes as anything greater than 100.
Finally, there's the International Diabetes Federation guidelines, and that includes an increased waist circumference. And the difference here is that the waist circumferences are ethnic specific. So, for example, Southern Asians have a smaller waist circumference criteria than Western Europeans. And combined with that, you have to have two out of the four following: either an increased glucose, an increased blood pressure, increased in triglycerides, or a decrease in HDL cholesterol. And they use the exact same criteria that are used in the NCEP guidelines when they determine an increase. So slightly different set of standards, but really more for an international rather than an American population.
How common is the metabolic syndrome? I mean, there are a lot of definitions, and there's a lot to consider, but just how common is it?
About 35% of adults in the United States have metabolic syndrome, and this is as opposed to about 25% in the past NHANES review. So we've gone from 25% up to 35% over about a 14-year period of time, and that is an amazing increase. It shows how common this is.
But when we look at certain ethnic groups, such as Mexican-Americans, the prevalence of metabolic syndrome is higher in Mexican-Americans. It's about 32%. It's lower in non-Hispanic whites, about 24%, and lower in African Americans, about 21.6%. Among the Mexican Americans and African Americans, the prevalence of metabolic syndrome is higher in women than in men. When you talk about age, as you get older, the prevalence of metabolic syndrome increases. So in people above 60 years of age, the prevalence of metabolic syndrome is up as high as 40%. So we have these differences based on age and ethnicity.
So if a patient has been diagnosed with metabolic syndrome, is he or she more likely to develop diabetes and/or cardiovascular disease?
Yes, there are several studies that show that. A study by Alexander and colleagues using the Haynes data, which we quote so often, patients with metabolic syndrome had an increased risk of heart disease. Another study among men, WASCOPs, if men who had 4 to 5 components by ATP3 guidelines for metabolic syndrome, their risk of heart disease was increased 3.7-fold. So, obviously, metabolic syndrome does lead to heart disease.
Metabolic syndrome also clearly leads to diabetes. There are multiple studies, from epidemiological studies in Wisconsin to the Framingham study to others, and they all show a pretty consistent increase. The risk factor in that same WASCOP study was that if you had 4 or 5 components of the metabolic syndrome, that your risk for developing diabetes was 24.5-fold increased. That's a pretty big risk factor. It's probably the glycemic abnormalities which are most important, to be honest with you, if you were to look at a single one, but all of them are predictive, and the burden of your degree of metabolic risk, which is a continuum and gets worse with age, clearly increases the risk for diabetes as well.
Many of the patients we met were concerned with the metabolic syndrome, and here's a question from one of them.
I have high blood pressure and high cholesterol, but I try to go to the gym 2 or 3 times a week. Do I need to be checked for metabolic syndrome?
There's no question that a patient like this is at high risk for metabolic syndrome. If 1 out of 3 Americans have it, we see here somebody who is at very high risk based on his weight alone. And while the fact that he's going to the gym may reduce his risk slightly, we still need to be sure that we're on top of this because of the amplification of risk.
Do we know if metabolic syndrome conveys more risk than the individual components themselves?
There's been a tremendous debate about this, and my feeling is that whether or not there is an amplification doesn't matter. I think it's very important to help people to recognize that they have this package of risk, whatever we call it.
Whether the whole is truly greater than the sum of the parts or not, we have to look at every individual component. The American Heart Association and the American Diabetes Association last year put together a position statement on cardiovascular risk and diabetes, and they made it very clear that a targeted, specific combination of lifestyle and medication program is required to deal with each one of its components.
We titled this program Cardiometabolic Risk Factors Hitting the Targets. So specifically, what are the therapeutic targets that physicians should aim for?
Well, I think overall the key thing is to recognize that you're going to target multiple risk factors that are related to cardiometabolic risk. And you can't do just 1 or 2. You've got to do a comprehensive approach. In 2001, the Adult Treatment Panel of the National Cholesterol Education Program suggested that there are 2 major goals, and this was reinforced with their later 2003 upgrade from the American Heart Association and the NIH. First, you work on lifestyle to try and reduce the cardiometabolic risk with increased activity, with a healthier diet, and then if you cannot achieve those goals, with all the multiple goals being important, then you add medication as is needed to get all the way to the target.
When it comes to obesity, the guidelines say that a 7 to 10% body weight loss is a reasonable goal. We know that's something that can be achieved by patients and maintained over a certain period of time. If we look at studies like the Diabetes Prevention Program, where a 7% weight loss was achieved, after 4 years, about a 4% weight loss was maintained, and that reduced the risk of developing type 2 diabetes by 58%. Interestingly, we now have studies showing that with that kind of weight loss, and we know that that 10% weight loss can reduce abdominal fat about 30%, that we can see an improvement in the production of adipose tissue cytokine hormones, as Caroline was alluding to before. There are a number of different factors that get better with that small amount of weight loss.
Okay, and to move on with the theme, we are breaking this into specific targets. You've talked about the target for obesity. What about the target for insulin resistance?
I believe that the way you would do this is by, again, targeting lifestyle change to begin with to reduce the risk of developing either prediabetes or diabetes, with those cut points being less than 100 is normal for a fasting plasma glucose, and greater than or equal to 126 makes a diagnosis of diabetes. So you're trying to keep people who have not got prediabetes from developing it and people who have prediabetes from developing diabetes. And once you develop diabetes, then you have specific glycemic targets also, and that is with fasting, you should see the blood sugars according to the recommended goals by the American Diabetes Association between 90 to 130, and that should lead to your ability to achieve an A1C at least less than 7%, but ideally even lower. ACE recommends less than 6.5%, and the ADA also says if you can get down to 6% or lower without undue complications, you should do so.
There are two other targets we really want to speak to specifically. One has to do with the target for blood pressure, the other, dyslipidemia.
So dyslipidemia, we're specifically talking about an HDL in men greater than 40, in women greater than 50, and a triglyceride level lower than or equal to 150. So these are earlier targets than previously thought to be a problem. So again, getting triglycerides down with diet and exercise and HDL up is very, very important.
The National Cholesterol Education Program proposes that in people based upon their absolute risk and the LDL cholesterol being the primary target of therapy, for those that we know have diabetes or cardiovascular disease, less than 100 is the LDL cholesterol goal that's proposed. For those who have lesser degrees of risk, it might be less than 130 or less than 160, depending upon your absolute risk. So it's important, as has been previously mentioned in this program, you don't stop there. You go on to the non-HDL cholesterol as your secondary goal. And what that allows you to do is to capture a number of the components of the metabolic syndrome. You basically shoot for an LDL target that you'd ordinarily shoot for, but you add 30 points onto it, and you subtract your HDL from your total cholesterol in order to figure out whether you've got to the target or not. And finally, it's important to raise your HDL cholesterol. It's very clear that raising HDL cholesterol milligram per deciliter for milligram per deciliter is about three times as powerful as it is for lowering LDL. But it's also kind of hard to do. We need both lifestyle and drug therapy in order to do that.
And blood pressure targets.
Blood pressure targets are critical, and I think they're underappreciated how important they are for accelerating all the complications. So the goal in general of people who don't have multiple risk factors is going to be less than 140 over 90, that is, away from stage 1 hypertension. But if you have diabetes or known cardiovascular disease or chronic kidney disease, which is also an important cardiovascular risk factor as well, then you're shooting for less than 130 over less than 80. And to achieve that, particularly with the systolic blood pressure, is difficult and may require multiple medications. Nonetheless, the data suggests that you can influence cardiovascular mortality by 25% or more by aggressively achieving and targeting such goals.